Thank you for joining us and welcome as we continue to celebrate our Women's History Month with another very special guest. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're watching or you're listening, however it is that you're choosing to do it, we are Answers Network and we are here for you. Every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, if you can't listen live, know that all of our shows can be found at answers.network. And I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world together. Now, our topic today is resilience. And I'm going to start with a story. Because I read a story about someone who was confused and frustrated that her child's experience at camp, with all the remarkable activities, gorgeous settings, and kind people, could indeed be so negative. Their child just wanted to go home. Well, this past summer, I heard many similar reports from parents. Many of their kids came home from camp early or seriously considered it. And they struggled with anxiety, relational difficulties, and other emotional issues. I checked in with the director of a popular summer camp, and she confirmed that at her camp and many other camps, more kids last summer left or talked about leaving than she'd seen in her decades as a camp director. When asked why she thought this was happening, she replied one sentence, a lack of resilience. Well, research has shown that many children, they wanted to leave because they felt too anxious, that they were annoyed, they felt excluded, they felt emotionally bullied, or some said they just felt sad, which I know that we used to call that homesick. But the children described an overall difficulty in getting along with cabin mates, navigating social situations, adjusting to other people's wants and needs, and figuring out things without their parents' help. Well, today we're speaking with therapist Sally Baker about her empowering new book, The Getting of Resilience from the Inside Out. Now, based on extensive experience and case studies from Sally's own therapeutic practice, this book provides gentle, perceptive insight along with tried and tested self-help therapeutic tools, free additional online resources, and the guidance needed to take the reader through the stages of negativity to self-empowerment. Now, Sally began her therapeutic training in physical therapies, working with women survivors of sexual abuse and domestic violence. She trained in EFT, which I'm going to ask her about in a little later on, and became an advanced level practitioner, followed by a clinical hypnotherapy certification and training in English modality, percussive suggestion techniques, and so much more. She was awarded the PSTEC Master Practitioner status in 2014. She is the co-author with Liz Hogan of 7 Simple Steps to Stop Emotional Eating and How to Feel Differently About Food. Her words are often featured in publications such as Grazia, GQ, The Independent, and The Telegram, and so many more. Sally, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan. That was quite a mouthful. Thank you.
Well, you know, I, for those that that haven't listened before and don't know, you know, my background is I'm an international detective, so research is my thing. So, so for everybody out there, that's what I came up with when I did the research, which is probably exactly why my producer wanted to get you on the show.
Lovely, thank you.
So let's start with the simplest question of all: what exactly is resilience?
It's not even a very simple question.
And it's I was joking when I said that. I know it's not simple at all.
Resilience. I mean, people talk about it being bounce back, some bounce forward, some talk about it being an inner strength. I mean, for me, it feels like it's around self-esteem, self-worth, self-belief, and built and having the trust in yourself that you can have an impact in your own life. And that starts in childhood, in a really well-rounded childhood. Yeah. So all those kids that are unhappy at camp, I'm wondering what's happening in the 11 months of the year when they're not at camp. What's happening in the dynamic at home? You know, are they being tested? Are they being pushed? Are they being allowed to make mistakes? Are they being supported to, you know, go out and broaden their horizons? Because if a child is helicopter parented at home, micromanaged at home, and then he's suddenly thrown into camp, it's going to be hugely challenging.
Well, I think that's a great point, and it's one that I also believe in. Do you think that part of this could also be that we're now conducting this type of research, or the research that I was finding, some of which was other people's research, is coming right after COVID?
COVID has had a tremendous effect on our young people, especially, and it's almost as if they're as a generation being gaslit by all mm-hmm. our governments, because no one's talking about it anymore. We have yep. huge amounts of children refusing to go to school or only managing to go in half of the week because of heightened anxiety. Politicians here are saying that young people, the millennials, are using mental ill health as an excuse not to work, which I find completely unbelievable, because every generation of young person has always pushed themselves to the front, to new frontiers, to leave home, to set themselves up, to establish themselves. And this generation has been really undermined by the pandemic and what we've all gone through. And we haven't had the mental support to help people out.
I was going to say, it's interesting that the way in which the politicians have phrased that, you know, in the sense that, you know, one of the things that we're supposed to be teaching our young people is to take responsibility, and yet you have politicians that are doing the exact opposite, and they're saying, nope, now this is the young people's fault. Well, let's take some responsibility about the situation you put them in.
Let's punch down and not lift up. That's what seems to be happening. Politicians are punching down and blaming people who are mentally unwell, hyper-anxious, socially anxious, depressed. No one wants to be in that state. That's a really unhappy state to be in.
Yep.
It's very wrong.
Yeah. And actually, I'm going to take that. I like that. Punching down versus raising up.
Yeah. They should be elevating us. They should be giving the young people the support they need. And in England, when the kids went back to schools after the pandemic, the government said, give them more maths lessons. They need to catch up on their maths. But actually, they needed, you know, room to explore what they've been through. They needed to tell stories. They needed to write, to draw, to create, and to play. And none of that was given to them. So not good.
Well, which, again, is why I think your book is so perfectly timed, you know, in the sense, because one of the things that I liked as I was going through it was that, you know, the book, again, for everybody out there, is called The Getting of Resilience. It teaches readers about how resilience affects various life situations, but it includes like relationships with families, you know, learned strategies, breaking of cycles, connecting to our intuition, cultivating rituals, and so much more. So can you give us an example of, you know, maybe some of the types of advice that is found in the family chapter that is maybe some of your favorites?
Okay, so looking at family structures, they're all wide and various. But dysfunctional families have very many things in common too. So children build resilience ideally in families where they're loved, honored, and adored, where they're heard, where they feel nurtured and loved. And it's possible, even in really high-functioning families, not to be able to give that to their children, because the parents might be doing something like putting huge expectations on the children to achieve academically or to achieve in sport or in music or whatever the niche is. And when that happens and the child fails, the parent shows their disapproval. And it's that disapproval to a growing child, it can be really damning and can be really undermining. So it's what we should be offering is unconditional positive regard to our kids. As long as they're doing the best they can, and we encourage them to do the best they can. If they fail or they fall short, we have to still express to them that we love them and accept them. You know, they can't all be geniuses. They can't all be Olympic athletes. But as long as we're encouraging our children to do their best, to explore their potential, and to love and to pick them up again if they fail, then we're doing good by them. That's what we need to be doing.
I love that. And again, as you said, you know, raise them up, you know.
Raise them up. Because no one else can like the parents can. And no one can demolish a child like a parent can. And I've seen parents be able to do that with a raised eyebrow. This is not about beating your children into submission. Children are very early to learn when they're disapproved of, when they've let their parent down. And it goes right to their soul. It does. It really does. Yeah.
You know, I want to kind of touch on, you know, when I talked a little bit about your background. And again, as I was researching, and I didn't know that, you know, that you had worked with women who had survived horrible abuses.
Yeah.
And really horrendous situations. And what it made me think of is one of the areas that I at one time, I don't know if you can say specialized in, but I did a lot of work in, had to do with rescuing primarily women out of human trafficking. And one of the most horrific statistics was that if you didn't retrain them in something that they felt good about. In other words, they had to get retrained into doing something that made them feel good about themselves. And if you didn't do that, there was a ridiculously high percentage that went right back into what they just been rescued out of. Yeah. And it made me think of the missing component was resilience. So share a little bit about your years at that time and how did this help you understand the importance of resilience as being the key factor for their survival?
Well, I'm an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse myself from when I was 7 and 8 and a rape survivor. But that's why I had skin in the game, and that's why I wanted to work with women who had suffered. And I did this through massage. I trained as a Swedish masseuse. What was my first modality. And the women that came to me would say things like, they've never, ever been touched with kindness. So I was massaging women in their 50s and 60s who had just had a complete life of abuse and violence perpetrated against them. And then they would break down, understandably. And I felt that I couldn't, at those early stages of my career in this work, I wasn't able to hold a safe space for them other than to bear witness and to stay with them. So that's why I learned my first modality, which was EFT, emotional freedom technique, which translates very well to physical work because it's this kind of tapping. It's an American modality.
Yeah.
And it's been around for about 35, 40 years now. So I would ask the women if it was okay if I could tap on them and we could just voice the feelings that they were feeling. And then all the sorrow would and their anguish would just come from them. And they'd have some, you know, a release from that. We hold it in our body. We hold all those things in our body, everything that happens to us. So yeah. But it's interesting about women who've been trafficked returning to old ways because that's all they knew. Mm-hmm. And I use a music box in my work.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people have had music boxes when they were kids. And I talk about how you get wound up. You know, you get wound up, something happens to you. It already starts leaking, the noise. Yeah. And when you get wound up, the music box gets wound up. It can only play one tune and it can only do one dance. And I say, you know, what tune are you playing? What habits are you on repeat? And what's your dance look like? And then we do the... And she finds it hard to stop sometimes. Look, she's doing it now. So... people on repeat pattern, people who get triggered up and go straight into repeating patterns of behavior. And a lot of my work is around noticing those patterns of behavior and then breaking them. But again, it's not enough to break. You have to replace with another action.
And that's the part that I love is the fact of taking it that next step. Because again, you know, as I was, you know, learning more about you and your book, and I was realizing that that seemed to be one of the biggest components, and where maybe things had failed in some of the, you know, some of the past situations that I'd been involved in, was that replacing. And again, I mean, replacing with love, replacing with, and again, I think, resilience, replacing it with something that allows them to, you know, to move forward. And I just think it's beautiful.
Have a sense of purpose. People need a sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. So to find, they have to find something that will give them that, or they will think back. Yeah.
Now, what have you seen that seems to be the some of the biggest blocks to people acquiring resilience? So again, I always, as I'm thinking about this show, and I'm thinking that there's people out there, and in some cases, I'm thinking there's somebody who's really resonating with what it is we're talking about. And if you can mention some of the things that you found that were the biggest blocks, that by getting past that, they were able to get to where they needed to be. What are some of those? So somebody out there, if we touch just one person and they go, that's what I'm doing.
Okay, let's definitely try and do that. So when I'm talking to my clients, I always tell them that no amount of therapy will stop bad things happening. But what is more critical are the judgments we make about ourselves, about the thing, the bad thing that's happened to us. And the judgments that we make seem to be more enduring than the event that we've survived. You know? So I talk about people having the sense of self-worth is determined, psychologists have worked out, by how you think and feel about yourself over the preceding 14 days. So if someone stops you in the street and says, oh, hi, Alan, how are you doing? And you go, well, you know, I've had a bit of a tough time, or I'm having a great time. You're probably taking a snapshot of the last 2 weeks. You're not going all the way back to your childhood. You're not going, you know, all the way back through decades. You're just thinking a snapshot of the last 2 weeks. So I ask my clients to imagine that 2 weeks ago, I sent them through the mail this glass fishbowl, and it has a whole bunch of marbles in it. And the marbles are gold marbles, and they are blue marbles. So I ask them to think about every time they've had a life-affirming thought about themselves, where they've treated themselves with kindness, where they've thought of themselves positively, they drop in a gold marble. And then every time they have they've made a negative judgment about themselves, every time they've said something self-deprecating, they've put themselves down, or they've been unkind to themselves, they drop in a blue marble. And then we get them to look at their bowl in their mind's eye, if I don't have the bowl in front of them, and to assess on 100 marbles what will be the percentage of gold marbles to blue marbles. And I've worked with a woman who was head of an international bank. She had 98% blue marbles and 2 gold. Wow. So it's not about wealth. It's not about how the world sees you. It's really about how you see and judge yourself. So any idea, Alan, where you would be? You'd probably be pretty good, but.
I work at that. So I would like to think that I'm probably, you know, more like a 60-40, 70-30 to the positive.
60-30, 70-40, there's still work to be done.
Yes.
If someone is very high on the blue marbles, very high on negative thoughts, it doesn't take much from the world to tip you over into real depression and anxiety. So it's really important to, you know, to personally find out what the marble balance is, and then start working on it, actively working on it to improve the gold marbles. And a lot of the blue marbles come from our childhood. The blue marbles often aren't even, the critical voice isn't even our voice, it's someone else's voice. So when I get them to think about the blue marbles, who is criticizing you? What idiom, what slang, what accent do they use? Who does it remind you of? And it's often a parent. It could be a father, it could be a mother, it could be a grandparent, or it could be a teacher. But that, so identifying and learning that actually the negative voice that's inside your head isn't even your own voice. It's a voice that you've adopted to put yourself down, is the beginning of starting to separate yourself out from these unconscious, toxic drip into your mind to be able to make some changes. Most of it happens below our conscious awareness. So bringing it into conscious awareness means that every time you notice that you're saying to yourself that same familiar, oh my God, I'll never amount to anything, I'll always be rubbish, or whatever you're saying that's negative, you can interrupt it. And I teach people a whole different array of techniques to interrupt the voice. One of my favorites, and they love it, is the game show noise. Whenever you notice a BS thought coming into your head, it's rubbish, it's a rubbish, just say it to yourself. You can say it inside your head, or you can say it out loud, but it's a BS thought, and you can interrupt it and intervene with a negative thinking.
And well, I would think that when you were working with some of the abuse or domestic violence survivors, that this was probably something that, you know, you mentioned how we get this from parents, teachers, and things like that. But I would imagine, I would assume that many of the people that are in a verbally or physically abusive situation, they probably have a whole bucket full of blue marbles.
They do. But the blue marbles are around, not about being the recipient of that anger, that violence that they've experienced, but they will be making judgments about themselves all the time, like, why did I stay, or why did I go, or why did I get with this person? And they'll be they'll be using that to beat themselves up, which will be harder blows than they probably ever experience. Our own negative judgments do us the greatest damage, and being able to re-explore those and to let them go, to release them, because we're only ever doing the best we can do. And it's not our fault.
Well, I'm glancing at the time. We're going to take a break, but for everybody out there, I think right now, everybody knows somebody that you can go, oh, this would be great. So we're going to take about a minute. And if you want to send a message out to somebody and tell them this is one that they want to listen to, we're going to be talking more about resilience, how to build it, and how to keep it. You're listening to or you're watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. We are talking with Sally Baker, and we are talking about resilience, how to get it, how to keep it, and how it really is helping us at any age. And we started talking quite a bit about, you know, with young people, and I am one of those people that, you know, I'm of the belief that, you know, that what we can do with young people is most important. But again, you know, we're talking about something that it doesn't matter what age, we can all go through times in which, you know, we're feeling depressed, we're feeling inadequate or whatever. And, you know, the more that I'm learning about this, the more I'm realizing that resilience is a huge part of this. So along those lines, so Sally, how would you tie resilience into things like depression? You know, when somebody comes to you and says, I'm depressed, you know, that's why I'm coming to you. you know, how do you look at that? And at what point do you realize that maybe a lot of this comes from a lack of resilience?
One of the things I would do very early on in our sessions is to timeline one's life. So we start it from birth and we take it all the way up to the day when we meet. And I explain that, you know, we're not really going to have any memories of birth, but we're going to have family stories, family legends, apocryphal tales of what kind of baby you were, a sickly baby, an angry baby, a sleepy baby. And families have stories all the time. So mm-hmm. we've got that on the timeline or about what kind of baby you were, and then we do it milestone by milestone. Might be when you went to nursery or when you moved house or when you went to college, all of those things. And we look at how you were feeling. Were you depressed then? Were you in balance? How were you feeling about yourself? What was happening in your life? What weight were you? Were you drinking? Were you exercising? Were you in any choirs or, you know, hobbies? What were you doing? What were your activities? And often, and then other unique things that get added to the timeline. Sometimes it's trauma events would be added to the timeline. How did that impact on one's sense of well-being and on depression? So we can see, once we've done the timeline, it takes about a whole session, about 90 minutes, we can see when they felt that their life was in balance and they were handling things very well, and when they felt that their life was out of balance and they weren't on top of things and they felt overwhelmed. And often it's tied to events, but it's also tied to many more subtle things as well. For instance, often people were feeling better about themselves when they were going to a weekly gym or dance class or joining a choir and singing regularly with other people or running or seeing their friends. And then they moved away and they can think, oh, actually, my depression correlates with me feeling much more isolated, or when I gave up, or when my kids left home, or when I got divorced, or when I got remarried, you know, all of that stuff. These mental health is often a reflection of all the external pressures that we're under. And if we can see how it fits in, we can put things back to rights. So.
Oh, and yes, I completely agree. And I was just noticing, we're getting a message that's coming in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time to send us in messages. Oftentimes I'll get messages from people that send them in ahead of time and say, you know, I'm going to be working and so I won't be able to listen until later. But we have one coming in now that says, what is your opinion as to how AI will affect resilience in the future? And this is from Mark in New York.
Hi, Mark. The absolute solid gold standard of resilience is human connection. And AI isn't going to promote human connection for any of us. And the fact that more and more services are going to be picked up by AI because of cost savings. So, mm-hmm. you know, you used to be able to ring helplines and get a human being, and now you're going to get an AI pretending to be a human being is yet another step of separation. I don't think it's going to help us at all. I really don't. It's worrying.
It's so interesting that you chose an example of one of my more frustrating things is the concept of help, that when we're asking for help, it is something that you want a human being for. And I find myself, you know, whatever it may be, but these lines where you call in and you're getting a recording and it's, you know, well, what would you like this? And I press zero or whatever it was saying. They go, please say what you want. I go, human being.
Yeah.
Representative. What word do you want that gets me a human being?
But it's terrifying to think that AI has a role already in answering or at least triaging people when they make contact about their mental well-being.
Right.
And they're desperate for human connection.
Right. And you bring up a great point. Is it's taking us in the wrong direction.
Completely.
You know, we're getting less of this. So if we have studies that are showing that, you know, that this next generation or whatever is going to be even more removed from human connection. And by the way, we're also going to put this in to make it worse. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And also you see young people, it's across all the generations now, on the subway, on the underground in London. You know, they've got their headphones on. They're not partaking in anything around them in their environment. They've got headphones on or the noise cancelling headphones, even if they're not listening to music, and then they're looking at their phones. So no one is part of reality anymore, frequently not part of reality. And then add in all the other AI stuff. It's not going to be good for our mental well-being.
Well, one of the things that I brought up, and I think I brought it up in the introduction, because the feeling that I got was a book that's providing advice in a gentle yet perceptive manner. Share with us the difference between that, which is what I see as your way of doing things, and what, at least when I was growing up, and maybe also being a male, was tough love. Because, you know, I grew up in the whole idea, you're going to be a man. You need tough love, and this is the way to do it. It was very aggressive. And the feeling I got from your book was, if you really want to make some positive growth in this area, try a gentle yet perceptive manner. And that's the feeling I got from the book. And I really appreciate that.
Thank you. And also the book has actionable steps that you can take to build your resilience. But what happens with tough love is that, especially men, they learn to keep quiet. They learn to keep stum. And that's why we have such high suicide rates and self-harming rates with amongst huge swathes of the population, but particularly with men, hiding in alcohol, hiding in class A drugs, you know, burying themselves with food. There are ways of hiding down, putting down, swallowing down all of their emotions. Men haven't been allowed to express their emotions, and it's worked against women as well. But we need our men to be empathetic, vulnerable, in touch with their emotions, and they've been denied it for generation upon generation. It's harmed all of us.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And one of the other things I had mentioned about, you know, as far as, you know, I felt that the book really addressed people of all ages. But in most situations, at least my belief is, you know, is that if you can catch them while you're young, you teach them as young as possible. What, in your opinion, is sort of the optimal stage where it's easiest to learn or teach resilience techniques?
From day one, really, from babyhood onwards, ideally. But also, I mean, in therapeutic terms, I don't work with anyone under the age of 11. It's just very difficult to find that 11-year-olds or younger than 11 have the emotional insights to be able to kind of deal with the work. But it's around 11 that the crisis point often happens with children. And then it can get worse, and they can get more oppositional and more challenging around 12, 13, and 14. But you'll see the early signs of it at 11. And that's when you need to bring them closer to yourself as a family, bring them in, bring them closer. Don't push them away. But also, I have not yet found any benefit of having tech in households. You know, access to telephones, access to iPads, computers for kids. It's not benign. It is not benign, and it has its own agenda. So I've often gone into families and been the bad cop who said things like, you know what, you're not going to be allowed to take your phone to bed into your bedroom anymore. You're not going to have the smart TV in your bedroom anymore. These are like talking to 9, 10, 11-year-olds. Like, I'm going to be the one, because the parents want to be their friend, and they won't put the line in place. They won't hold the boundary. So I'm often brought in to be the bad cop who will hold the boundary, say, actually, this isn't acceptable behavior anymore. And then I spend a lot of time getting the parents to be the fixed point, be the adult in the room. Like, they're not your friends. These are your children. They're not your friend. They need you to be the adult in the room and to be the fixed point, not the vague, oh, yeah, okay, you can have it, whatever. To be the fixed point that's saying no quite often. And it's unpopular, but that's what we need.
I am synergizing with you so much, and I think I may have even shared this on the air, but in speaking with one parent some years ago, and as they were explaining to me all of the reasons why they couldn't do any of the things that either I or whoever they were seeing, whatever professionals that they were getting advice from, they were trying to justify all of the reasons why. And then at one point in time, and they said, but, you know, if they do that, they're not going to like me and everything else. And I said, stop. And they went, why? And I said, Your child does not need a 45-year-old best friend. It needs a parent that knows how to parent. Yeah. And they were stunned because nobody had ever spoken to them like that.
Yeah. Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And when the parent becomes the fixed point and holds the boundaries, the kids relax because they're no longer under pressure. They haven't got people kids at school Snapchatting them at 11 o'clock at night because the phone isn't in their room anymore and they can't respond. So the children can relax. The children can sleep. They're under immense pressure all of the time from these external factors. And someone has to draw a safe boundary around them and say, actually, we're not going to play. We're not going to play. We're not going to put you through this. I'll take responsibility. And I'm saying no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It actually reminds me of a story of something very similar that I did. We were providing like a behavioral consulting type of service for the parents. It was a situation in which the professionals involved thought that although the child should go to a specialized program, they also had abandonment issues. So they wanted them to be worked with, but still kept in the home. And one of the things that I had said was, okay, you know, here's the rules as it relates to the computer. And like you said, it, you know, it doesn't go with them in the room. It stays in a common area and it's used, you know, for homework or whatever, because now we have schools that are sending homework in by computer. So you can't tell them, well, you can't use the computer. They have to log into a site to be able to do it. So, but anyway, as I went through all of this and when it was violated by the teenager, I just, you know, I showed up at the house and we had tracking in the sense that we knew exactly when people had logged on and it had been logged on in the middle of the night and actually had gone to a porn site. And so I showed up and asked the young person, I said, you know, I've got this information here. Is this you? I said, well, yeah, but you know, it's okay or whatever. And so I just unplugged it, picked it up, took it in my car, and the child was stunned, you know, and it was a divorced family. So the mother was trying to stop me. And I said, this was the rule. You signed the agreement. They signed the agreement. I'm taking this. And I got a call about 24 hours later from the father that said, the mother bought him another computer.
Wow.
And so I went back, I took the computer, I handed it. I spoke to the father and I spoke to the mother and I said, I'm letting you know, here's my final bill. We're done. And they went, well, no, you can't do that. And I said, there's nothing that I can do. I said, if you're going to continue to sabotage what it is we're trying to do, we're not doing anybody any good here. I said, all you're reinforcing to the child is that they don't have to do whatever it is that they say they're going to do because you're not going to follow through. And we left. That was it. It's like, and I said, you know, I go, there's plenty of people that want our help that are actually going to follow through. And anyway, so my synergy with you when you were saying that was it brought back all of these thoughts.
Yes. And also, if the child is too young to work with or not, doesn't want to work with me or whatever, you know, they don't have to. I get to meet them and they can at least get to decide whether they think we can do productive work together and they're going to commit to it. Then I'll often work with the parents instead. Because if I can bring clarity to the parents and to help the parents become the fixed point and to have faith in their parenting and build their intuition, because you know often parents aren't intuitive either and the kids definitely aren't, so build their intuition so that they know what they need to do for the best will of the child, then that can be the benefits of that go intergenerationally then. So that's another way to approach it with families. Can't always work with the kids.
And that makes perfect sense to me. And while we're on the subject of these influences, now we're talking kind of about the electronic influences. And when I did a little research and I checked with the Pew Institute, which is one of the ones that I believe is not slanted by political issues, Anyway, a recent Pew Institute study showed that 64% of Americans believe that the media is affecting us in a negative way by focusing on negativity and divisiveness. What do you think mainstream media and social media's role in overall negativity has affected resilience in our society?
It's undermined resilience, and it's also, we just had it in England this week with Princess Catherine and the faked photograph. So we're always told to have an awareness of, you know, are you being scammed online, or these are the checks that you've got to make, but you don't actually expect it to come from Buckingham Palace. So that we're under everyone's radar for a while till the news agencies pulled the photograph, did a kill on the photograph that someone adopted. I don't believe for a moment it was Catherine, but someone adopted. Resilience needs reality based to work with. And when we're faced with fantasy all of the time, or scams or lies or treachery, so that it feels like shifting sand, it's really hard to get a firm foothold in what you trust and don't trust. So it's very limiting access to stuff online that kids don't need other than for school is a really good. Get them outdoors, get them making vitamin D, get them playing with their peers. Get, you know, be there, keep them safe and all the rest of it. We've had this helicopter parenting and this closeted couple of generations now where they've barely gone out, never been on public transport on their own. And it's making them really hyper anxious and not at all resilient. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take another break. But again, for everybody out there, we're talking about resilience. We'll be right back. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Sally a little bit about your mission in regards to writing a book like this. So again, stay with us. You're listening to or you're watching Answers Network. Having a teenager at risk who is going through a traumatic experience can be difficult on parents, siblings, and all who are working with that young person. No family should have to go through this process alone. West Shield Adolescent Services is here to ensure you don't have to. Many of the psychologists and psychiatrists we work with have spoken about the stress families go through. Not just the young person, but the parents, needing to get their child to a program where they can get the help they need. West Shield aims to lessen that stress. Every case goes through a thorough intake process with one of our knowledgeable, compassionate intake coordinators. We want to know the likes, the dislikes, and the fears of each child. This important information is taken into consideration when choosing the best suited team member for each individual teenager. West Shield agents come from all different walks of life, giving us a diverse group of team members to ensure a personalized, compassionate experience for every teenager. This allows us to make certain every young person we work with gets to the chosen program in the best possible state of mind. We contacted over 600 of the youth we've worked with in the past to see where they're at now. 97% of these individuals told us how much their lives had improved, that they had better relationships with their friends and families, had gone on to marry, have kids, and were now using the skills they learned in their program to raise their own children. Our role of transporting at-risk teenagers is a vital step in the process of ensuring a youth's ability to thrive in their new environment, and is a role we don't take lightly. The recovery process can be a long one, but like any journey, it started with a single step. And we're back. We're speaking with Sally Baker, and we're talking about her new book, The Getting of Resilience from the Inside Out. Now, when we went to break, I mentioned about, Sally, your mission. What would you say is your mission in writing this book, and what are the most important points that you'd like people to learn from this?
I think the takeaway that I want people to have and to understand is that if your childhood wasn't the ideal childhood that you would have wished for yourself, you can repair some of that, some of the things that you didn't have that you weren't able to develop as an adult. And it's, and you're not stuck. You're not stuck with self-sabotaging behavior. You're not stuck with self-doubt. You're not stuck with having no working intuition. You can build and take actionable steps to change how you think and feel about yourself, and to start checking in with yourself and building incrementally self-belief and self-trust. And it's revolutionary. I mean, ideally, we would have all of these things in childhood that we would face adulthood fully equipped. And I know those people are out there. They're not my client base. They don't come to me. Those people who had really great parenting, or had the bit of the very positive voice in their head because of their great parenting, they're out there living their lives, living it large and having a great time. They don't knock on my door. The people who knock on my door had narcissistic parents or absent parents through alcohol or drug use, not through working parents, but just through emotional absence as well, or helicopter parenting, or parents that really undermined their ability to stand on their own two feet. So all of those things can be repaired, and there are actionable steps that they can take to do that and make a difference for the rest of their lives.
For those people that also kind of work in a similar industry or a similar capacity, how do you keep that from taking you down the rabbit hole? Because I think that there's a risk that when all we see in our work is, you know, the times in which it's not working, how do you stay positive, and how do you keep your jar, your bowl full of the gold marbles when, you know, when most of what you see business-wise are the people that are bringing you the ones that are full of blue marbles?
Sure. Well, like all therapists, I have supervision, but also within session, we laugh more than we cry. That's an absolute truth, because the work, once we've done the narrative, once we've done things like explore the timeline, I often work with metaphors. So people don't have to disclose horrible things that have happened to them unless they want to, unless they feel that it's part of their healing process. They can use a metaphor like the blue dress or the wet Wednesday, because people already know what's happened to them. They absolutely remember it in the finest and most accurate of detail. So often retelling it, and some of the modalities out there where you have to retell your story in forensic levels of detail, can feel re-traumatizing. So the way I work is content-free quite often. So they don't have to go back through their story unless they say, you know what, I've never told my story. I really wanted to have someone on the earth who knows exactly what happened to me. And then I'll be that person. They can tell me. The person that was the oldest that disclosed her sexual abuse for the first time in her life, she was 68. She kept it secret for 68 years. And she told her story, and I listened, and I bore witness to her story. But, you know, everyone's needs are different, and it's an organic, customized kind of program, like your work. It's what it's to work with where people are at and to give them what they need. And often the techniques are taught. The idea isn't to tie them into a therapist. I'll teach them ways of thinking, teach them ways of testing their thoughts so that they can stand independently, be their own ally. That's the thing.
Well, Sally, first, I just want to thank you for all of the good work that you've done. You've been making a positive influence in the world. And I think what a lot of people need to realize is that, you know, for someone like Sally, you're working in an office. And I think that you realize that you're making a positive difference one at a time. She's now taken the time to put a book out, because I see it as someone who wants to make a positive difference on a much bigger scale. I think you're doing that. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
And for anybody, if they want to get in touch with you, I know the book can be gotten at most anywhere, but you know, what is the best way if somebody now, either they're listening, they have some questions, or they just want to get in touch with you, either for an appointment or maybe a better way to get the book?
Yeah. So my website is called workingonthebody.com. So www.workingonthebody.com. And I'm there.
All right. Yes. In fact, in the email is sally@workingonthebody.com. So
I'm in London, but I work the world over.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And that's actually the beauty, but a lot of people don't realize the beauty of therapy today, is that, with, Zoom, StreamYard that we're on right now, or any of these things, there's so many of them now that there's so many things we can do by. We can work with people anywhere in the world, and I think it's really opened things up in a very positive way for us.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much.
Thanks, Alan.
All right. And for everybody out there, be with us next week when we're joined by Mike LaCorde of Conflict International Investigations, and he's going to discuss to reduce the chances of getting fooled in the world today. And for everybody, visit our archives of past interviews, and you can do that at Answers Network. Just go to answers.network. It's that simple. Or you just subscribe to the show. You can do it through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, BeatChute, and so many other popular podcast formats. And, if you like what you hear, please leave a review. I'm learning about, if you leave reviews, if you leave comments, we want the show to be the best possible thing it can be to you. So leave a comment on how we can improve things. Or if you disagree with something, let us know that. Maybe it'll be a topic that we'll talk about in the future. And the next time that you're on Instagram, Facebook, or X, remember, stop by our page. Check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.